You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to another edition of The Orthodox Nationalist. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And I'm not certain when this is actually going to get released. I'm going to go away for a while, but it is being recorded on the 6th of October, 2023. And for better or worse, we have to continue this discussion of the difficult philosophy of Martin Heidegger. He's important to a lot of people. He was a member of the National Socialist Party for a short time. And yet he is still taken very seriously by, although mangled, by the academic establishment. As always, you know what I was thinking? If someone were just to write me a check for $100,000, you know, my birthday's coming up, I wouldn't have to ask for money anymore. You know how much I hate doing that. But I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there. I'll name my next cat after you. Speaking of which, Stanley's next to me. He says hello, sort of. And he's much better behaved than when I first got him and he was knocking stuff over and all that. He's long since lost contact with the MI6. I feel a lot better about it. Anyway, Heidegger is like Hegel. He is not easy, and yet his influence is immense. His life really took up almost the entire 20th century. He lived through all of the depressing events of that century, and so much of what he wrote and said has to do with his dealing with these things. Now, last week, you know, my paper on him is now at 26 single-space pages, and it shows no sign of diminishing. Even if we don't finish it this week, we'll finish it some other time, because he is very difficult. Oh boy, cats are fighting. Until we finished up with the idea of death in his very idiosyncratic way. Of course, it's an Orthodox concept. It's a Christian concept. No, I'm sorry, it's an Orthodox concept. I think of Christian, I think of something vague, the evangelicals of the postmodern world. But death brings us to a concept of time. And the worst way to understand time is something that's standardized. There's 60 minutes to an hour, you know, 24 hours in a day, etc. That's certainly not how time has traditionally been considered, since that is not how we experience it. Time is connected to our contingency, which means it's connected with death, which also means it can't be made into an absolute. Heidegger is, I think, too hard on Plato, because the core of this whole thing is Heidegger's belief that by referring to objects, even ultimate objects, like a form or an archetype, is an error. That is not how we experience anything. That's not how we come to understand anything. It implies that these things are closed off from everything else, that science can somehow understand it and understand it exhaustively. And that's just not the case. Science is itself an ideology, a form of standardization. Now, he's much harder on the moderns. So much of his idiosyncratic thinking comes from the fact that Descartes locked up the ego in himself, changing everything, turning the ego itself into an object, as if the ego is the same thing as the person. In fact, they're quite opposed to each other. Nevertheless, the whole idea of taking an abstract, externalized thing as an object, removing it from its context, from its history, viewing it as the way that Descartes later did with his own selfhood, as some eternal unchanging entity. Now, there are internal unchanging entities, but again, we have never experienced that before. I found that Nikolai Berdyaev, who I've spoken of many times before, does make understanding Heidegger a little bit easier. In fact, he cites Heidegger a few times. But his, the slogan that you can use to understand him is that neither knowledge nor truth can be found in these objects, per se, that we think are external to us. Now, as far as God is concerned, forms exist in logos. That's true, but our relationship to it is highly fragmented. We're very limited. We're contingent. We're going to die. Forms don't appear to us as concrete universals. It is true, though, that their content is slowly disclosed and unveiled in history. One of the reasons I became interested in Hegel many years ago was how abstract Plato created, how he understood the forms. I like the idea that these forms, to be experienced, or to be understood even in a small way, because our understanding always is fragmentary, they have to be placed into history. They manifest themselves slowly over time, relative to the ethnic group, relative to the nation or the civilization. Not relative to themselves, though. It's their slow unveiling over time. When Heidegger would use the Greek aletheia. And we understand that, not necessarily in these grand philosophical tomes, but in day-to-day practice. As I said last week, the day-to-day, our moods, our attitudes, Heidegger is the first one to take these seriously. Now, both Berdyaev and Heidegger talked about Nietzsche quite a bit, especially in the sense that he has been wildly misunderstood. And Nietzsche didn't write in such a way that he would be understood. He understood that only a tiny group would ever really come to understand them. Now, what interested Heidegger in him was that it refers to the primary concept as not an object. And an object is not the source of knowledge in this case. Knowledge sometimes is even put forward as the domination over something. Francis Bacon's or Thomas Hobbes' idea. An object is not even close to the idea of being with a capital B. Both Heidegger and Berdyaev thought that they understood Nietzsche in a way that he understood himself, the concept that's foreign to modern academics. But let me quote, and I like quoting Berdyaev because he's a very good writer. I don't think this has ever been translated. This is his article, Rebellion and Obedience in Mass Psychology, which came out in 1907. And it's very relevant here. And he's making fun of how the left has taken Nietzsche somehow as their patron, despite how absurd that is. And he says this, and this is my translation here. Those calling themselves Nietzscheans began to walk around in the crowds. Everyone suddenly wanted to become supermen. Everyone becomes puffed up, bursting with self-inflation. This democratization of the idea of the superman is not only a blatant contradiction, but it's also a moral and aesthetic vulgarity. A herd of supermen, of course, will be no different from a herd of sheep, since the torment of superhuman loneliness and all the inevitability of the exodus into the divine human subordinos will be unknown to it. Now, as I've said many times before, the worst thing that could happen to a philosophical concept, including something like the will to power, is that it be manifest in mass society. The minute it's taken abstractly as something that you can believe in, quote unquote, it's destroyed. And it's not just that, it's many philosophical concepts like this. The will to power isn't really about power as such, not as some abstraction. No existentialist really talks abstractly. It's about those who sacrifice themselves within the concept of design, as we spoke of last week, the lived experience. I'm going to get into in another article of Heidegger's. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. In other words, what Berdiaev is trying to say is that they took this as an excuse for antisocial behavior, for anarchy, for self-assertion. But that's kind of what happens when an idea like that reaches the alienated mass. Of course, Nietzsche's writing about me. Now, I use the word object a lot. This is something we use every day. It's something that we see as external to us. Often, I use it in the sense that we're talking about a constitution, I mean, written down on a piece of paper, or a body of laws that you can access and reference. Now, that's a highly limited aspect of being, and could never exhaust it. Heidegger is quite famous for saying that even if you were to gather every single object in our world, it wouldn't come close to exhausting the concept of capital B being. They would just be mere beings with a small b, as a collective things, objects. Even together, even if you got them all together, they wouldn't create any sort of community, but they would be an abstract collective. A community and collective clash as much as the ego and the personality do. The meaning of being is about what makes these objects intelligible as objects. And whatever that factor is, actually it's design, it's not just one thing among others. Being is always found in the objects that we encounter day to day. That's how we experience them. Being, with a capital B, itself is not a thing. It's not a meta-object. In Being in Time, Heidegger says this, whenever an ontology takes for its theme entities whose character of being is other than that of design, it has its own foundation and motivation in design's own ontical structure, in which pre-ontological understanding of being is comprised as a definite characteristic. Therefore, the fundamental ontology, from which alone all other ontologies can take their rise, must be sought in the existential analytic of design. And that's from section 3. Everything that Heidegger says, very much like Hegel, has to be broken down and almost translated into a normal English. Design isn't experience. We don't approach this as subjectivity. We don't experience it as objectivity. Maybe it sounds like it. Design, however, is our primary experience, and this is where philosophy has to start. The everyday encounters with various things that we normally take for granted. We take them for granted until they break or something like that. Now, he starts off with a type of phenomenology, something else we've spoken of on this program before. But it's not, in this case, how things appear in experience. A phenomenon is an appearance, not necessarily an object. But one of his teachers, Kurt Husserl, who died in 1983, talks about phenomenology as a theoretical practice that takes ordinary experience as the primary experience. What that means, of course, is what the dialectic ends up being all about. That's the starting point, though. And we could take this apart to expose being with a capital B, what counts as a transcendental condition that shape and structure our experience of things around us. This is not empiricism either. Don't dare go there. Empiricism itself is loaded with assumptions. But being with a capital B, these are the conditions in which every kind of being, that facticity, the beings around us, may possess, as he would say, persist as determinative for the character of its being. Again, same thing. It's presupposed to be found in day-to-day experience. These conditions have to be present with or found within that experience, and therefore they can never be abstract. You can't write them down and expect that to be an experience. Now, what does this have to do with time? We call this an event of intelligibility. The being that makes everything cohere, that makes an object that we know about and that we can use or something like that. These are moments in the life of design. And of course, typically, it has a threefold makeup. It's essentially a version of the past, present, and future. Last week, we talked about what thrownness is, meaning that we're born into a world that we didn't create, but it's the same world that to some extent socializes us. And that's, of course, created in the past. But then there's also projection. That's towards the future. We're thrown, and then we also have to project. But we can't project unless we understand the past, we understand ourselves and the world around us. Now, the present is far more slippery. It's what he calls either falling or discourse. That's the present, or the daily interactions with things. Now, each one of these goes beyond itself. It's just a momentary aspect of being. The past has to be realized towards a future through the present. But each one is related to, dependent on the others. So, given that, the most inauthentic, false conception of time is a standard clock. Time is related to design, and it's why the truth is defined as an unfolding, or an unveiling, or a disclosure. Time is about experience, not quantity, not numbers. The medieval conception of time made a lot more sense. They weren't standardized. Hours in the winter were shorter than hours in the summer. And the round of services followed that. Now, phenomenology is a term I use once in a while. It is a form of interpretation. On the one hand, it's guided by our historical embeddedness, that we're part of an ethnic group and the language. But of course, always, it's open to revision, it's open to enhancement, or its possibilities. It's never a closed understanding. Ideologies tend to be closed in on themselves. This is all you need to know. Of course, he's referring to ethnicity and in quotes, the civilization that it helps create. These are the master texts, and they condition everything within its view. Of course, through language and historical experience. And even, you know, it's manifested even more local forms of being, but they all partake in the overall design. It's not personal. It's not collective. It's not a thing at all. It's the German version of Subornost. And I don't know how many people have mentioned that before, but they sound very similar to me. But this isn't a limitation on our understanding, the fact that we're thrown into it's a precondition of understanding. So the opposite of this, the inauthentic approach, would be to impose liberal categories of politics on societies that have no conception of them, that they reject them or just have no use for it. It's the assumption that being is the singular object and possessed, by the way, only by liberal advanced powers. That's one of the highest forms of bad faith. You need to rationalize that. It's not rational at all. Design can only be itself, but its being, its presentation, for lack of a better word, can be twisted and become inauthentic. Now, the main book, of course, Heidegger is Being in Time. And the book itself is an unfolding of what he considers being to be. And he's talking about this circle, really self-referencing knowledge, that is to say, the ethnos, as a form of knowing. And one of the things he says in this case, page 195, the edition I use, he says, our last and constant task is never to allow our forehaving, foresight, and foreconception to be presented to us by fancies and popular conceptions, but rather to make the scientific theme secure by working out the four structures in terms of the things themselves. The nature of ideology, the nature of bureaucratic time serving, especially through fashionable ideologies, really the life of a university professor, for example, it's one of the main manifestations of Das Man, or the they, as in they say that something is true. Of course, there's a tension between things like ethnicity, the state, culture, language, as design, and they're connected to the conditions that make possible any specific mode of being at all. The transcendental is not an abstraction, but it's, and this is Hegel's victory, it's become historically embedded. And that's why ethnicity in the nation lay at the root of design. Now, let me explain this in a way, and this is one of the reasons I think his essay from 1951, Building, Dwelling, and Thinking, makes sense out of a lot of what I've been talking about. It's a, in quotes, it's a solution to the problem of living a lie, inauthenticity, bad faith. The point is to overcome anxiety. It's overcome by seeing oneself as a historical project. We are part of something. We're part of a historically constituted community, the ethnic group. Now, many years ago, in The Voice of Reason, I analyzed this essay as a way to understand Heidegger. Of course, anxiety is built in to the technocratic regime that we're forced to live under. So what do you do about it? Why did he join the National Socialist? Why did he think the National Socialist Party could be, however brief it was, a great movement? And he did think that. Man has to realize his roots, and that's permitted only to certain people. This is the foundation of both ethnicity and agrarianism, and the agrarian life is something Heidegger made a big deal about. That you are really a part of a community, one that can love and love you in turn. Subject, object, inner, outer, all that is overcome because our identity is taken from this community, and the community takes at least a piece of its identity from our action, especially in our labor as a member of a guild or a union. It's what I call the metaphysics of place. It eliminates the distinctions of the one and the many and all that. It's the idea that our neighborhoods, communities, people, the institutions, things like the landscape, weather patterns, which are important, the economy, this isn't separate from who we are. Now, of course, today we live in a technocracy. It's very difficult to find a community at all. Most people have no idea what a community is, but a true community. Not a collective of just anything. It's something that we're thrown into, but that's a good thing. Or at least it's a thing. It's a reality. It's something that we internalize, but the distinction between internal and external here really is not useful. The key word is dwelling. To dwell with a capital D is to find peace, is to remain stable, to be preserved from harm. It's a community, not a collective. Heidegger talks a lot about caring. We don't do anything, really, unless we're forced to, that we don't care about. We interpret the world. Design has a lot to do with what it is, historically speaking, that we care about. We care about things like independence and virtue and courage under pressure. But when we say that people look after each other in a true community, liberals make fun of that. Where they secretly long for it. They claim to be promoting it, but of course they have no foundation for it. That has everything to do with what Heidegger means by caring. Liberal individualism is a symptom of decay. It's what happens when community starts to rot. It's certainly not a goal to be pursued. Institutions and the concepts that they create in Heidegger and in Hegel, they reflect who you are, largely because they've helped shape who you are. It doesn't mean you're not a free agent, but you're only free relative to these institutions. A real healthy community is one organically connected to the basic virtues, not values. Values as concept of alienation. Families, institutions, and the ideas that derive from this. And the highest level of this is the nation, not the state, not the constitution, the ethnos. So to dwell is to live within an extended family. Now, the title of his essay is not an accident. Building, Dwelling, and Thinking. Building comes from dwelling. We are part of, or we attempt to find, a community that requires work to maintain. You build up its strong points. You compensate for its weak points. building can only come from dwelling and not the other way around, which is, you know, very much a typical view of Heidegger. Our selfhood is never abstract. It's something that's constructed in and as history. But since freedom is never abstract, it's never just a freedom to do as you please, which is absurd on its face, because on what grounds would you pick one thing over another, other than your own passions, in which case it's not free? It doesn't limit freedom, but it does limit the options available to us. Virtues, of course, require freedom, but freedom is not an individual achievement. It's a non-stop struggle, and it's inherently social. Dwelling is just another term for a living, breathing design. Now, he lays out four concepts, elements, that lay at the root of dwelling. The first is the earth. He means that literally and figuratively. It refers to, as always, stability, the land, agriculture, and a place, but not a place in a quantitative sense, a place as something that you can have affection and care for. I mean, it could be as simple as saying that a desert creates a different personality than a beach. The plains of Nebraska create a different personality than the mountains of southern Pennsylvania. The earth is the stable element, the stable sense of identity grounded in everything about the place. It's terra firma. But of course, it's not alone. The second is the sky or the element of air. Now, he gives a few different definitions to the elements of the classical world. Earth, air, fire, water, etc. But the sky, or the air, is the heavens. It's freedom. It's purpose of unfolding, the presence of spirit. This is why Berdyaev is important. The spirit of a place means that, of course, it's larger than the physical institutions, than the geography, the earth aspect of this. It refers to the ideas that derive from dwelling that themselves drive building. The third, the religious structure of the place, how it understands itself, its final purpose. And lastly, death, but more specifically, the commemoration of those who have died. And it adds a new element to the classical four, you know, Aristotle's four. But of course, those are symbols, not literal things. And the fact that someone dies has nothing to do with their influence. Their influence is very present. And it's a large part of the community. There is no conception of a community that doesn't take much of its identity from people who are no longer here. No being could exist without these. So in any specific arrangement, these four things, growing up organically through time and revealed in our own day-to-day action, create dwelling. The community, a place where our selfhood can be protected, created, but never closed off. Now, the one thing he doesn't mention is government. Because governments as states, not nations, are two different things. States, politicians, want to take the concept of dwelling and use it as a way to extract money and influence. A democratic politician is a total fraud. Of course, politics, in the true sense, is far more substantial than that. And it comes down to how people constitute their very central, their critical being, as close to true being as they can get to, and how it operates and works creatively through different circumstances, different pressures. Things like the television are enemies of this. Both Berdyaev and Heidegger are just repulsed by the idea of standardization. Major media, of course, tells us what a, quote, good person is, or what a productive person is. The media is the last group of people that have any right to dictate this. Comes from the regime, the very highest element of Dasein or bad faith. The regime is at war with Dasein to the creation of its own completely artificial being. Real dwelling has to do with an organic development, not an artificial one. There's nothing less organic, more mechanized, violent, or unbalanced than the television newspaper combine, the regime's center of its information and propaganda, especially since the owners of these institutions are aliens. With a design known only to themselves, we know a bit of it. But they are strangers to our design, the design of European ethnic groups, and they're hostile to it, and Heidegger does actually mention them. We'll talk about that in a second. In other words, there is space, there's location, there's structure, which creates the personality. It creates the possibilities that we have to work with. Space, like time, is not an abstraction. It's something that's created by dwelling, given the arrangement of things, you know, human activity, their guilds, labor, architecture, and how that shapes our thinking in any given time. And that's what creates a true sense of being with a capital B. That's as close as we can, using, you know, typical language, get to what design is. Space is something that's created. It's not accepted abstractly like a grid, you know, a grid on a page, the ultimate standardization. Space can be experienced. Architecture is very important here. Artwork is very important here. The architecture, to be organic, has to be very close to the tradition, the topography, the experience, this social universe of a specific group of people. But within a specific community, it's really the only way that philosophy can ever work. It's being in its true sense. And that's what this essay is telling us. I mean, who really feels at home in Manhattan in 2023? Who built these skyscrapers, and to what purpose? The closest that a place like New York City got to actual design are the ethnic communities. The Russians, the Irish, the Italians, in different parts of the city. But they were deliberately destroyed. There's only one group of people that finds its home in Manhattan, and that's the Jews. And they helped destroy these design that maintained order in this now ungovernable mess. So dwelling in Heidegger's world, this real extended family / community, is really the relationship between the person and how space is created, changed, and experienced. And so we create a single unit that's beyond internal, external, subject, object, one and many. Architecture, again, is very important here, as is art. And it's not even so much that Heidegger rejected any concept of universality. It's like Berdyaev or even Johann Herder. Herder is probably one of the few philosophers, though I don't think he says so explicitly, that could be rescued from Heidegger's overall critique. My only problem with Heidegger is that he seems to suggest, like, someone like Hobbes and someone like Plato are making the same sort of error, and I don't think they have anything in common. A form is this very, very different, or an archetype, I should say, is very different from an object that the way science looks at it, science in our definition of the term. But universality, or truth, is experienced by, you know, these enculturated people, not individuals. An individual is an abstraction. A person and a personality most certainly is not. And it's experienced, in that sense, very different than an abstraction that may be imposed from above, like an ideology. But this is something that liberalism demands. The least organic mentality in the world is that of modern liberalism. And what I've said before, it's the Platonic archetype, it's valid in and of itself. But Heidegger's question, because, you know, Heidegger's vehemently anti-nominalist, as was Berdyaev, the problem is how these archetypes are actually experienced. So maybe Jung would be more significant than Plato. Plato, of course, may be a foundation. And especially in the mundane realities that form the root of what we call design. That's why Hegel was necessary, to make greater sense out of Plato. That's why Hegel works. What Plato did was very skillful and extraordinary. But he wasn't in the cultural position where history mattered that much. It's something that creates communities. And these communities will experience the forms, the essences, as Plato laid out, differently from place to place, without violating the foundation of the philosophy in general. I'm not so sure that Plato is referring to an object that you could grab, that there's a form of the good that I can go and look at. That's not what a form is. Now, many years ago, when I did Heidegger, The Voice of Reason, to 2010 or something like that, I made the argument that European-based ethno-nationalism can really find a religious home only in the Orthodox faith. And it's because it's the way that the Orthodox world is organized. Historically, it's been organized. That each linguistic cultural group possesses its own Orthodox church, if it's at a certain point where it could have one. that's controlled by, not just by bishops and clergy, but the laity too, all speaking the same language, and they all love the same local tradition. And this actually is laid out in the canons themselves. That's why I made such a big deal about that ridiculous synod about, the 1872 synod from the Fanar and so-called Philotism. I've dealt with that several times a few years ago. It isn't a denial of truth. It's just that it will be encapsulated differently from place to place without altering the essence of this. There are many different customs within the Orthodox world. I spent 3 hours, not about 4 years ago, on the Montenegrin idea. You don't see that. The Montenegrin idea, specifically, it's a Serbian idea, of course, but it's very different from the day-to-day understanding of the faith that we deal with us in our daily reading. It's explicating the same truth in different ways under different circumstances. This is what the Zion and being are. That's why the ethnic and traditionalist concept of Orthodoxy works. And really, no other church has a basis that's explicitly ethnic. Now, I've mentioned Sobornost many times. I've also mentioned Bonapravna, which is the Ukrainian version of the same. They're not identical, but they're similar. And that also deals with the collapse of the distinction between inner and outer, the one and the many. It's not too far from design. Sobornost takes into itself both your typical, abstract doctrine that you could write on a page, which is hardly the fullness of it, as well as the praxis that gives it content. That's what Heidegger would call the most primordial aspect of the faith. And it's even related to the Garden of Eden, where our first parents acted without concepts, without language in the sense, without language in the sense of words or syntax, maybe language more broadly, they communicated. They functioned intuitively because sin was not involved. They were not all-knowing. They were just very innocent. They were like children. And I think that's why we have a revulsion. The worst sin you can commit is the destruction of innocence, especially crimes towards children. It is just this revulsion that doesn't need words. And this ultimately goes back to the destruction of the innocents in the garden. Now, God himself exists outside of any objectification. He's not one object among many. And design actually makes sense out of this, as Berdyaev does too. He's active being, active love and freedom. There's no determinism there. And there really is no domination in our scientific sense of the word. This is all connected with what most of us know is the apophatic theology. We can't formulate a concept of God as an object, because object always means objective. It's based on determinism and externalization. It's a rationalization rather than reason. God can only be thought of symbolically because his content is infinite. It's known only within the Trinity itself. We can make a few negations about God, that he is not limited, for example. But all of these terms, as far as we're concerned, are symbolic because our terminology comes from our highly contingent and limited experience. The apophatic is something essential to both Heidegger and Berdyaev, but only Berdyaev mentions it explicitly. Of course, it doesn't mean that God is unknowable in any sense, but there is a meeting, there is a communication with God in terms of a dramatic struggle. And we meet in things like the sacraments. This is a meaning of communication, and which includes struggle of people within the community, between whom there is neither determination nor causality, nor dominion, no subordination, at least in that sense. The faulty theology and philosophy, as Berdyaev says, it contains something like the exteriorization of the spirit, which is automatically an error. This process always distracts from internal spiritual experience into the arena of abstract thought, into science. Design is manifest spirit. It's beyond subjectivity and objectivity. And that's where a real sense of transcendence occurs. The objectifying direction of our consciousness transfers it elsewhere. Objectification is an apparent achievement, but it's rather a distortion. So, Heidegger is talking about locations as a part of being. And at its depth, it's apophatic, because our words are symbolic. But they're a start. He's talking about the living tradition of a people, one that exists relative to many, many variables, which themselves overcome objectivity and subjectivity. The language is mine, but it's also the community's. So which is it? The fullness of the ethnos is not expressible in normal language. It presupposes normal language. Things like ritual, linguistic conventions, ritual in the broad sense, goes pretty far. We're given a sketch of its being. Experience is integral. It's what Heidegger would call pre-scientific and primordial. Not the result of scientific analysis, but it's the foundation of scientific analysis. To put it in the most simple way I can, these variables that affect our day-to-day life and that of the nation, they're always bleeding into one another. They're always overlapping each other. These concepts that we can use, these words that we can use to describe them, they're abbreviations. They're not realities. Taking them as realities is the error of errors. To take a concept, let's say like abstract freedom or abstract equality, taken as a reality is bad faith. That's the opposite of freedom. A location, a community, has to be externalized in space. But how we experience that is neither external nor internal. Of course, it takes into account local traditions. That's a manifestation of design. They bound our experience of space, creating a specific culture that, of course, creates healthy families, and healthy families create a specific culture. Space is quantitative just like time is. It's not presupposed in action, as Kant would say. It's created by it. But it's open to continued improvement as time goes on. That's really what a possibility is. And this comes from design. In fact, it's part of what design is, lived experience. This is the origin of care in our attunement to it. Now, there's no grand ideology here, because ideology is one of these enemies. Abstractions are not design. They're not being. They're not even beings. They don't exist at all. They represent inauthenticity. We don't experience ideologies or abstractions. We invent them, or people with power invent them. But we don't even experience the good with a capital G. We experience it in specific manifestations. And these manifestations are only understandable within a specific local context. That is being. The life within that is design. So without understanding something's context, purpose, and history, you can't understand the phenomenon. Even something like area studies in political science, where we focus on a specific area, Latin America, Russia, China, even that, it remains an abstraction. It's not lived experience. But we still, even as outsiders, we talk about the creation of space, which is part of the creation of design, the creation of healthy, well-adjusted human beings. Now, in one of his less theoretical, actually it was a talk from 1933, infamous, The Self-Assertion of the German University, it's called. And this is one of the central quotes here. And again, these non-theoretical terms. He says, "The spiritual world of a people is not the superstructure of a culture, any more than it's an armory filled with useful information and values. It is the power that most deeply preserves the people's earth and blood-bound strength, as the power that most deeply arouses and most profoundly shakes the people's existence." This is what gets the academics going bonkers. Yeah, they could worship Mao for an entire career, but you say something like blood and soil, you're not worthy of consideration. These stupid books like the Heidegger Controversy and everything else, they presuppose that all of this stuff must be false, and so we have to rescue Heidegger from it. So then they interpret Heidegger in a way that he wouldn't understand. A lot like Dostoevsky or Gogol, the way academia deals with people who reject academic liberalism and who mock it, in fact. They're either ignored, and they're not talked about at all, but with someone like this, you can't ignore them, so then you reinterpret them. I guess the third option is just to condemn them outright, which has certainly been the case with Solzhenitsyn over the last 20 years. Now, blood and soil, they're two ingredients to authentic life. It's inherent in the essay we're talking about here. It's essential to design, but they're not sufficient for it, of course. These are powerful means to come close to the truth of being. And you really can't reduce these to an ideology that we can write out. The lived experience, there's only a piece of that experience that could come out on paper, that could come out in conceptual apparatus. But in a true community, the sense of being will become a part of you. And it has nothing to do with the overall truth of it. That's not affected by it, but it can be affected by your own actions. It's not external or alien anymore. There's nothing internal or external about it. It just is. It becomes a part of you as much as you are a part of it. Even the concepts of me and you are vulgar. It's the thinking of a simpleton. Using words like me or, you know, they're external. I mean, me as a substantial category, not just as a practical fact. It only matters in a case of extreme alienation. And people who use words like that are usually enemies, the community. True community, coming from the ethnos, the extended family, removes the distinction between subject and object, the institutions and the way of life, and this is how design is revealed. It becomes part of how you think and talk. The lines, distinctions between concepts or among concepts are blurred and eventually eliminated. But over the course of a life, that is, of a community as well as a person, circumstances are always going to arise that require creativity. But you never abandon it. And this is the life of design. Freedom is not harmed by any of this. In fact, dwelling becomes a home for it. It becomes a necessity for it. That's the problem with modernity. Once you are part of a people, and these people are a part of you, anxiety is strongly lessened. The world that Hobbes created, that Descartes, even Machiavelli created, is permanently without a home. If one of these farmers, let's say in an agrarian community, goes bankrupt and gets taken over by the Great Reset, those who dwell, with a capital D, will stand and fight. And that becomes a core presence of design to preserve the integrity of the community. And Heidegger says this about the battle to preserve the nation. And this is from his on Heraclius' Fragment 53. He says this: the enemy is one who poses an essential threat to the existence of the people and its members. The enemy is not necessarily an outside enemy, and the outside enemy is not necessarily the most dangerous. It may even appear that there is no enemy at all. The root requirement is to find the enemy, bring him to light, so that there may be that standing up to the enemy, so that our existence does not become apathetic. Now, for several quotes now, he's used the words the people or a people. The dishonest way of approaching that is just any gaggle of human beings or things that look human. Of course, that's not what a people is. That's a ridiculous definition. It's a specific people that have language and customs and virtues in common. It's an ethnic group. It's design. People, the term people has become abstract over the years, but of course it isn't. And he mentions apathy, what we would call abulia. The refusal to take action in defense of design, either due to ignorance or corruption. It's bad faith. It's dishonesty. The will to fight is the opposite of abulia. It derives from this settled life of dwelling, the humanization of nature. And Heidegger does mention the Jews. And he says that they have no capacity for this. They're permanent nomads in his world. They don't even have a sense of their own rootlessness. They see others inherently as just material to be used and manipulated for their own purposes. And Heidegger is not shy about that, especially back then, in the 30s. The concept of integrity is a part of being rather than an object for scientific analysis. And when that distinction is covered over and it is eliminated, that's when dwelling begins. This is the opposite of alienation. This is integrity. That's the nature of this battle here, to remove alienation, to create real dwelling, to eliminate anxiety. You read Hegel and you get Plato. You read Heidegger, you get Hegel. Manifests in very, very different ways. Now, in 1947, after the war, Heidegger wrote his Letter on Humanism. And, you know, it's something that you have to read a bunch of times before you get his meaning. And he says, "Thinking's come to an end when it slips out of its element. The element is what enables thinking to be a thinking. The element is what properly enables. It embraces thinking and so brings it into its essence. Thinking is the thinking of being. Being has faithfully embraced its essence. To embrace a thing or a person in its essence means to love it, to favor it. It is on the strength of such enabling by favoring that something is properly able to be. The enabling is what is properly possible, that whose essence resides in favoring." Now, as eccentric as the language is, it is profound. An essence, in Heidegger's terminology, is a fulfillment of a destiny or a purpose. Another way of putting that, it's bringing something into its home in design. That's what enables. But he also says, "Being's history comes to language in the words of its essential thinkers," which is a very significant utterance here in this context. Of course, truth and being are historical entities, a presence. Now, what is essential and what is not is the job of poetry broadly considered. Otherwise, history is just a collection of events. It's not. It's an unfolding of meaning. The poetic intellects of a society can bring this out. It's really one of the purposes of art in general. You could even say it's the collective unconscious manifest through history. The collective unconscious is interesting because that itself is not really a thing. It's not an object, or else it would be conscious. But it is a presence. It's a collected experience within the archetypes of a growing society. The unfolding of history, and hence the destiny of peoples, occurs essentially as a destiny of the truth of being, as he would say. In order for it to be properly understood, the older idea is that these are objects, that there's an individual that faces a collective, that science is the only way to knowledge. Those ideas have to be eliminated. And that elimination is what Heidegger calls destruction. Again, with a capital D, it's a technical term. It's a direct challenge to what has been handed down intellectually, but handed down intellectually as bad faith. So, for example, the idea that, you know, Hitler was evil, Mao Zedong was fine. This is what has to be destroyed. Heidegger uses a term, first time he uses it, he's referring to the early works of Martin Luther. Now, of course, I don't like that, but I understand what he means, because Luther thought he was hearkening back to what he thought ancient Christianity was. And in doing so, he had to put aside what he called the accretions of Rome. This is a big ask. Now, he was wrong in fact, but the examples, you know, for the sake of argument, the example works and it goes far to understanding what Heidegger's talking about. Metaphysics, even if it's a perverted one, derives from the truth of being and exists relative to history. It forms the meta aspects of culture, what Alexei Losev would call the mythic aspect of history. Myths aren't false. They're symbolic in the true sense. They're a gateway to being. They give us a glimpse of it. Whatever comes from this can't be removed, can't be cast aside. And he says that it can only be used more primordially, sheltered in being itself, and removed from the domain of mere human opinion. Now, inside, within this same design and its being, things like discourse and debate have a strong role. But in order for that to work, the people involved have to have a lot in common. They have to be engaged in dwelling. Debate, in fact, builds that foundation stronger and stronger. They find what is fitting for them, the destiny of being, or their ethnic context at a specific time. That actual discourse, of course, it can't exist in the modern West because it's not a life world. It's artificial. It's inorganic. But debate without many foundations in common can't function at all. Social cohesion is critical. It's a critical component to knowledge. And it's a product of being with a capital B. Discourse outside of this is just another term for warfare. Violence that erupts when the ties of community weaken to the point where our commonalities, one with another, are weakened and even severed over time. Our existence thinks, cognizes in terms of being, and is thus historical. But it's not just because so much happens to man in the course of time. It has to think in terms of design. The mentality of Heidegger and being in time is concerned that the historicity of design be experienced, mastered, as neither a personal nor a collective possession. The error, as I've said before, is that being has been seen as transcendent, or the way he puts it, a transcends, pure and simple. A transcendence, I should say, so the noun that articulates in a simple sentence the problem. That's the accretions that he's talking about. The assumption is that being with a capital B is this fundament. The essence of being has to come from a comprehension of beings and vice versa. So in this way, thinking attests to its essential unfolding as destiny, and destiny can only come from the nation or the ethnos. He's not talking about declaring all past, philosophy falls. It's the question is whether or not this fundament, this thing that people thought was being, being as such, pure and simple, does that really express what we mean by being? But it also suggests that being is understood from its meaning, from the truth of being, as a matter of history mediated by language and experience. It's still ethnic either way. But it's not an abstract entity, transcendence. We also spoke of the distinction between anticipation and expectation. Anticipation requires that design acknowledge the way that its past, its history, mediated by language, of course, makes it what it is. Anticipation demands of design that it project itself resolutely onto one of the various options established by its cultural historic reality. Anticipation has what Heidegger calls a moment of vision. Design, in anticipating its death, because these are not eternal forms, and because it may die, pulls away from conformism and refuses to accept the ego regarding the ego-dominated distractions of the present, because the vulgar only live in the present. Design also is an anticipation aimed at the future. I mean, even the idea of man, humanity, is exceptionally dogmatic. But design is never dogmatic. It's critical in the philosophical sense. It's a matter of phenomenology. The destiny of a people comes to pass as the uncovering of being. Think of the canonical tradition, the Orthodox Church. How did it come about? It wasn't somebody in isolation writing a manifesto and those canons became the law for the church. No. These truths were unveiled in struggle, that is to say, the struggle against heresy. Remember, in the first millennium of the church in the East, there was not a single heresy that wasn't sponsored by the state. And elsewhere, I go into a lot of reasons why that's the case. The church existed as a matter of constant rebellion here, usually as a tiny minority. But these experiences are as much of the canonical tradition as the words on paper. They didn't come from nothing. They came from passing through the crucible of suffering and the threat of death. And this ultimately is how design presents itself. And it certainly would be the case here. The truth was unveiled in history as a matter of struggle. Yes, of course, these guys could have simply gone along because the state said to, or the majority said to. Yes, they would have saved their lives in some cases, or at least their limbs. But a determined minority refused. That's true personality. That's what design is. It's a militant rejection in that circumstance. Dwelling is not the same thing as living. Living, existing, is being a part of the mass. And these people who are cut off from their own design, from their own being, what we call mass society as part of modern urbanization, they become vulnerable to demagogues and charlatans, media figures, celebrities. In Heidegger, the nearness of being is something that comes from poetry. Heidegger talks about the concept of the homeland, and he means that metaphorically. The poet is very important. Inauthentic people can't read poetry, or at least they can't comprehend it. The concept of homeland is meant to contrast the homelessness of contemporary man. They have no conception what design is, even without using that language. A poet permits the ethnos, the nation, to become conscious of itself. Now, of course, the state is an abstraction. It's a creation of modernity. That is not ethnicity. That's not local identity. That is not dwelling. The state has really one role, and that's to protect the ethnos. But that also provides it with resources for deception. Machiavellianism. But that's what the masses can understand. The masses are upset with oppression only because they're not the ones doing the oppressing. The state, in service only to itself, is the same thing as egocentrism. The ego serving only itself and projecting itself onto everything it sees. The ethnos is very deep. And the poets, and I mean that not specifically poets, just poets, but art in general, the self-expression of design, takes into itself tremendous content. It's its being, developed over centuries, and certainly it can't be exhausted with words. Poetry is, in a broad sense, a strong step to understanding design. Even that can only go so far, though. But the dishonest approach, I want to quote Berdyaev here, because he's talking about how dishonesty functions in left revolutionary ideology, which, of course, in his time, they overlap in time quite a bit here. We talked about the poetic utterance versus the utterance of ideology, or, you know, the manifesto or something. And Berdyaev says, and this is from the same place, Rebellion and Obedience in Mass Psychology in 1907, freedom is mixed with licentiousness and arbitrariness, honor with pride and vanity, assertion of personality with self-deification and self-inflation, justice with self-interest and vindictiveness, the individual torment of anarchic revolt among the best people, among the aristocrats of the spirit, leads to religious submission. In an anarchist-minded crowd, there is no such religious torment. There is only the complacency of rebellious slaves. Now, this quote I use in a paper on Heidegger because it goes to the heart of what he's really talking about here. You take a concept like justice. People talk about it all the time. And I say that most of them are using it inauthentically and dishonestly. You could take it in two different ways. The first can be an aspect of being, drawing out clear problems within the tradition of the people, the ethnos, the nation, within the nation, for the good of the nation. Or it can be taken as an abstraction, as a slogan. And that's what Berdyaev means. It results in vulgarity, serving passions rather than the reason that is present. It manifests in design. The moment something, no matter how good it is, no matter how holy it is, the moment it becomes objectified in some ideology, bad faith results, and sometimes even terror results. It functions as the anti-design. Like we talked about the Nietzschean Superman, the minute that's vulgarized, though used by anarchists, for example, everyone thinks that they've reached this level, but no one has. It just becomes another stupid excuse for violence. Now, I've gone pretty far here. I know I'm over my time, 5 minutes over my time. I'm not sure there's going to be a part three. There might be. If there is, it won't be next week. But I truly appreciate you suffering with me here and helping me understand this difficult but very profound man. Certainly, I don't agree with everything here, but at least it's extremely interesting. Alexander Dugin takes it as his core ideology when talking about liberalism. And in that sense, it could be very useful. Thank you again, everyone, for listening. And I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.